will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
To the downside of venture capital.
People said, well, don't sweat the small things. Well, I guarantee if you don't sweat the small things, the big things are going to become a mess.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
Don't want to wait until you jump off the cliff to grab a parachute.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO.
Hello, everyone. This is Ray Zinn. I'm the author of Tough Things First. Welcome to another Tough Things First podcast. We really appreciate you joining us and listening to these podcasts. My guest today is Trey Taylor. He is the author of a new book, brand new book, called A CEO Does Only Three Things. I'm so happy to have you on, Trey. So why don't you give us a little bit of background on your book and why you wrote the book, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, Ray, great. Thanks for having me, and good to be with you. I get asked this question a couple of times a week now, with the book being on Amazon and doing a lot of media in support of the book. And the answer is pretty simple. I heard a speaker one day say that the only moral imperative we have is to be the person we needed when we were younger. And I thought, gosh, that's just a good way to live your life. And I really noodled on that for a long time. And one of the answers I came up with was that I needed a book on how to be a CEO when I was a young CEO. And so I set that out as a journey a couple of years ago and wrote the book and sort of present it as a gift to those CEOs who are starting out now. But then as the book has come into its own, I've heard from CEOs who've had the position for a long time that there's wisdom in it for them as well. Sort of that concept of finding your focus in the C-suite again. And so it's had a really good reception in the market, and for that, I'm grateful.
You know, so it's interesting. You know, a CEO does lots of things. So, you know, your book really focuses on the three things that they really have to do, as opposed to the three things that they do. So, you know, it's interesting that you concentrated on the three things they must do, as opposed to the many things that they do on a daily basis.
Sure.
Having been a CEO for 37 years and run my company through many downturns and difficult times, I can certainly empathize with your point that there may be lots of things they do, but only three things that they must do. So let's go review those, if you would. Trey, I'm going to let you start off by talking what's the first thing that they must do?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just like you and I were talking previously, you know, every CEO says, oh gosh, I wish I had three things to do and only three things to do. And of course, we understand that. We understand that the task list is always there. The to-do list is always there. You have things that you need to assist in, things that you need to touch, that sort of thing. But the three things that we think a CEO should really only do are the three things that the CEO only can do. No one else in the organization can own those things. So those three things are culture, people, and numbers. And when we talk about those, we talk about those in terms of the CEO setting the agenda and giving the model for what a successful implementation in each of those three verticals looks like. So yeah. If we took the first one, it would be culture.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how important culture is.
Yeah, I think that culture is the prime strategic differentiator between you and your competitors. Very specifically, culture is the shared system of values that show up in the behaviors of your people. No one wants to overmanage another person, and God knows no one wants to be micromanaged by another person. And so culture is sort of the invisible manager of people, always standing in the back of the room saying, wait a minute, let's make sure that we're doing things, in association with our values. And so we know if we look at the root word of culture, it's the same root word shared by a lot of other words that are important, like cultivation and that sort of thing. And so when we look at it and break it apart, your culture is that which you nurture, that which you care about enough to provide it with nutrients and sustenance and that sort of thing to make sure that it's prevalent in your organization.
Yep. You know, in my book, Tough Things First, that I wrote several years ago, I focused mainly on the culture of the company.
Sure.
And at Micrel, the company that I ran for 37 years, our culture was number one, honesty. Second is integrity. Third is dignity of every individual. We never allowed any swearing, you know, condescending language at the company. And the fourth is doing whatever it takes, no excuses. In other words, we all make mistakes, but as long as you correct it, no harm, no foul, then it's okay. So that was the four cultures that we had at Micrel.
Yeah, that's great. And I would assume from hearing those four things that you have an extremely execution-oriented culture, that you guys set your milestones and you hit them. And because of that, you could see those things, those values that you just shared, showing up in the behaviors of your people and producing the results that you wanted to see.
Absolutely, which leads us into your second point, because you know, employees are the backbone of the company. And without your employees, your company is nothing. Everybody has brick and mortar, but it's the people that make the difference. And at Micrel, the company I ran, we had the highest boomerang of any company in our industry. Over half our people who left the company came back. And we had the lowest turnover in our industry. So on an annual basis, our turnover was like 7% compared with 15% for the industry.
That's amazing. Yeah. And that's exact testament to the CEO's job of selecting the right people to be part of that culture, you know, recruiting them in the right way, but also to your point, retaining them in the right way. And sometimes I get raised eyebrows from CEOs to say, well, wait a minute, you expect me to go recruit people to come into the organization, and then you expect me to mollycoddle them while they're here so that they stay with the job. And, you know, the answer to that is, yeah,
absolutely.
That is what we expect of a CEO.
Absolutely.
And we have to change, you obviously have done this, but we have to change this mindset almost to a Hollywood mindset where we talk about talent, recruitment, retention, you know, making sure that we've got the right leading man or leading lady to play the role in the script that we are writing. And when we change CEOs' minds about that, when we show them how desperately important it is for them to be engaged with the talent, engaged with the people, and what that does for the overall long-term success of the business, we really have an impact.
You know, and that's why I believe that we were so successful is because of the fact that we did believe in our people. We built upon that premise that people make the company, not the other way around. We really did coddle, as you would, our people, and we made them feel like they were at home. I talk about the company is nothing more than just an extension of your home. Anybody that understands why they work knows that they work to provide for their family, and so family is number one. And so having that a culture of the company is just another room in your home, makes them feel more like it's home.
Yeah, it does, I'm sure. And you see that in the results that you shared with me a second ago, that you know, people might look and say the grass might be greener over there, but they don't stay long. They come back, right?
Exactly. That's what we call boomerang. People that leave but come back. I mean, over half our people who left the company did come back or wanted to come back. So let's talk about your third one. Go ahead.
So the third one is numbers. And, you know, some of the pushback I get from CEOs when I say that, you know, numbers is part of your job, some of the pushback is, well, I have a CFO for that. You know, the CFO runs the numbers. But we're talking about something a little bit different. So what we want to see is the CEO saying in a very transparent way to everyone in the organization, this is how we make money. This is how the money is spent once it's made. These are the things that are important, and this is how we measure them. These are the milestones that we look at, that sort of thing. Other people may own the task of tracking the numbers and reporting the numbers and saying, hey, we're falling short here and let's pull up here. But the CEO really has to be forefront in saying, that this is what is important to us as an organization and setting that agenda for the numbers.
Yeah, they own the numbers. The CEO owns the numbers. Okay, so you know, say what you want. You know that business cycles go up and down, and you know everybody has problems, and we have to work our way out of a situation. But the buck stops at the CEO's desk. He owns those numbers.
That's exactly right. And so many CEOs and CFOs today have this sort of pact with the devil, right, where they split that responsibility. And you and I both know what happens to split responsibility. No one ends up carrying it. And so I don't think that's right. And I think that when I study really great organizations, the CEO at the end of the day knows what Wall Street knows, which is he owns the numbers.
You know, that's what we did, is made sure that our employees understood those numbers. We went to great pains to communicate those numbers to every single employee of the company, regardless if they were a vice president or just a person working on the line. We wanted to make sure they understood the numbers and how they were arrived. And so, you know, we all took ownership in these numbers, but the buck stopped at the CEO's desk. And it worked out well, because once my people knew that they were part of the success of the company and its numbers, then they took ownership too. And so, you know,
that's exactly it.
Yeah, you don't have just the boss taking ownership. You have every single employee wanting to be part of that ownership.
Yeah, we have a great story that came out of one of our consulting arrangements where there was a manufacturer who had a large line built. And, you know, as you do on those kinds of things, technology improves. So after 30 years of running some old equipment, they upgraded the equipment. And the expected productivity gains didn't arrive. And they really couldn't figure that out. So, you know, of course, they have to hire consultants to figure that out. So the consultants come in and they go talk to the foreman. And the foreman says, I don't know, we're doing all of these things, everything's correct. And you know, he goes down onto the line itself, and he looks at the guy running the line, and they're on a 2-hour break. And he says, well, you know, why are we on a break here? This is brand new equipment. And, you know, why are we just sitting around waiting on it to cool down? And the line guy says, well, we don't know, but, you know, we've always done it that way. And no one ever asked us why we would take 2 hours a day after we replace the equipment. So just talking to the guy down on the line, they figured out immediately that they were still running things as if the old equipment was in place. And as soon as they identified that and fixed that problem, all of the promised productivity gains came in. The funny thing about that is how many companies would never have figured that out because they don't go and talk to the people closest to the problem. And we see that a lot of times. Great CEOs really do management by walking around and talking to their people and figuring out what to do. If you don't share with the people what's important in terms of your culture and your values, in terms of what it takes to get someone on board and keep them on board, in terms of what the numerical definition of success looks like, then you don't really have anything to talk about with those folks anyway.
You know, it reminds me of a story that I heard, you know, many years ago. A 9-year-old girl was watching her mother prepare a Sunday roast, and she would cut one inch off of each edge of the roast. And so she was curious as to why her mother did that. She says, Mom, why do you cut off so much of the roast? And her mother says, I don't know, ask your grandma. And so anyway, so the little girl one day was with her grandma, and she asked, hey, grandma, why do you cut off an inch off each side of the roast? Her grandma says, oh, that's because that was the size of pan we had. And so, you know, it just goes to show you that, you know, habits are hard to break. And you know, we do things because that's the way we used to do them.
It's so true. And we see it in my own organization, which is a 52-year-old organization. I'm the third generation in that organization. And we see it all the time. And it really means you have to question a lot of things. And sometimes they're sacred cows for a reason, you know, but a lot of times they were making the best of a situation 10, 15, 30 years ago, where really and truly it doesn't make sense to do it that way anymore. And we uncover that, of course, in so many organizations. And the key is that the CEO has a unique perspective, sitting on top of the pyramid, if you will, seeing everything that happens below them, gives them a special prescription in their lenses to be able to say, wait a minute, maybe numbers and people isn't, maybe they're not coming together here to work the way that they need to work, that sort of thing. And so, you know, we uncover a lot of success that way.
When we hire new people, they would inevitably say, well, that's not the way we did it where I used to work. And I'd fight that tooth and nail. I'd say, you know, you're not where you used to work. You're here at my Krell. And so I don't want to hear about, this is not the way we did it at where you used to work. And so, you know, for those CEOs who are listening, do not accept the premise that if it's not like it was at the other company, that you have to change. So, you know, you change it if you think it's right, and do it the way you want to do it and the way your company best adapts to the problem. Trey, I'm so grateful that you joined me on this podcast today. It's good to hear about you and your book, and so let's rehearse now. Where can we buy your book, Trey? I'm sure you're at Amazon and others, but let's talk about where you can buy it.
We are, yeah. We're definitely on Amazon, and in the launch of the book, we've been really gratified to achieve the Amazon bestseller status, beating out some really good other books as well. So Amazon, Trey Taylor, T-R-E-Y is my name, and you can find it there. A CEO only does three things.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Trey. I appreciate you taking the time. Once again, please join us each week on the Tough Things First podcast. We have great messages and great people that we interview and great subjects that we cover. You can find my book, Tough Things First, also on Amazon and also your good book retailer. And also my new book, Zen of Zen, which, by the way, my second book of Zen of Zen will be out shortly, probably in the next 6 months, so you can see it. So again, please join us again on another Tough Things First podcast.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.